this is July 15th, 2014. 15th? 16th. See? At least it's July. I'm Rick Hansen. And I'm actually really glad about being able to talk to you. Because for me, this one's a little unusual. And I'm wanting to double check. The reason is that I have a heavy heart. And I want to talk with you tonight about practicing with a heavy heart. My heart is heavy. I'm not sure entirely why. We have an aging cat who's declining rapidly. I think that's a lot of it. When you have a heavy heart, other things seem to add to the heaviness. Some idiot on TV, you know, some minor setback at work. Your daughter hasn't called you, you know, it adds up. It's not horrible. And I think for some people, their heart is heavy a lot of the time. Maybe they're grappling with depressed mood in general, or kind of a background of anxiety or physical pain. It's interesting that of all the medical ailments that are listed, and they're often described in terms of these long lists of potential symptoms, and then if you were to sort across all those various symptoms for the most common symptoms, across various medical illnesses, conditions, and so forth, the most common symptom is depressed mood. So maybe there's some kind of weariness. Maybe there's a fatigue. Maybe there's something. I mean, I'm really okay, and it's actually a rare opportunity because normally I'm fairly cheerful, as you probably know, kind of sanguine in my take. And so I thought it would be really good to talk about practicing with a heavy heart. I mean, I think everyone's heart is heavy sometimes. And a lot of people's hearts are heavy a lot of the time, if not all of the time. So how do we practice with a heavy heart? I want to structure this in terms of the three ways of practicing with the mind, in my view, to let be, let go, and let in. So in terms of letting be, I want to use the Buddha's five aggregates as a kind of roadmap for being with a heavy heart. So as you may know, the first of these aggregates, which is his way of sort of sorting reality from the five lines, the actual origin of the word for aggregates, skandhas, the origin is heaps, piles. So Buddha basically sorted all of material reality and our barest perception of elemental perception as the first aggregate. So if one's heart is heavy, you would mean recognizing what the facts are, it could be related to that without adding anything to those facts. Like, oh, cat, friend. Our cat is a very close friend. So close friend. And so, oh, cat, fine. Oh, some setback at work. Fact. But mostly, the sensation. So it's the sight, the perception in the first aggregate. The sight, the sound, the taste, the touch, and the smell, but especially the touch, including the interior sensation of the experience. So what's a heavy heart feel in the most basic physical way? A weightiness, a roundness. What is it? We're not trying to change it. It's really okay having the vacuum on the knowing, but sometimes just being in the experience helps it shift and become something else. But as soon as you start nudging, especially a heavy heart, have you ever noticed that it gets stronger and weightier, more like a bowling ball in the middle of your chest? Well, it's important to truly do it. Walks across. So we be with form. What is it in terms of their sensation? Second, and we be with aspects. Oh, that's weightiness, that's pressure. That's an increase. That's a decrease. We're right there with the raw experience. We're not adding anything. The second aggregate is the feeling side. Keep on pleasant. Or neutral. And then think it's kind of interesting because you ask yourself, is this heavy heart really unpleasant? It's actually kind of sweet. Oftentimes, that weight in the heart is sort of sweet. So if we go directly to our experience of it, we realize, I don't need to resist it. I don't need to resist the form of bare sensation. And I don't even need to resist it if it's unpleasant. So maybe it's not even that. It's something like salsa is sort of hot, delicious, you know? It's a combo. So that's the feeling part. Be done. Pleasant, unpleasant. And as you probably know, Buddha allocated one of the four establishments of the foundations of mindfulness, the fundamental practice that he taught me. He allocated one of the four to mindfulness of this feeling because on the heels of the pleasant is very often craving for more, right? And on the heels of the unpleasant is very often craving for go away, get out of it. So that transition from the feeling to problematic desire is a critical link in the chain that leads to suffering. So it's really useful to have a lot of mindfulness. Can we deal with the unpleasantness of this heaviness, this weightiness, this depressiveness, this worry, this weight? Can we just do it without fighting? Practice for the heaviness. Then there's perception, the third aspect, which means essentially recognition or labeling. What is this? What is it like? And also memory stuff. Like, what could be earlier layers in the parfait of the psyche of this experience that we can recognize? That's an aspect of perception. What might this remind me of? If I had other losses in my life, imagine the loss of our cat might remind me of my mother's death about 7 years ago. You know, the kind of weightiness around here, sort of things that I thought would be relatively easy to pull off. I'm realizing, wow, one more round, a lot of effort, I really have to laugh. It's going to be okay if I don't. So I have to particularly homework. And, you know, what does that remind me of? In my childhood? Other disappointments. Or, you know, feelings of sort of, you know, potential inadequacy. So that's perception. Again, we're not getting caught up in a lot of self-psychoanalyzing. We just recognize, recognize the nature of recognition, perception. You might even label it. Sometimes it's quite helpful to label. Oh, dread. Oh, dread. Or, oh, this is what depression feels like. Oh, right? That's perception, recognition, labeling. Thanks for that. So we're disentangling, we're unpacking our experience when we be with it, when we practice with a heavy load or anything else that's different. The fourth aggregate are called sometimes the volitional formations. And it's a little tricky because a lot of them arise and they don't seem very volitional at all, right? They don't seem very deliberate. It's just a chatter in the mind. It's just somewhat impersonal process of thoughts and emotions and desires and various trips about things. And, you know, my nature in the Enneagram is a social seven, like always wanting to kind of rise above pain, cooey. Well, here we are. Guess what? Well, boom. Not Errol Keenan, leaning over the pit of vipers with a smile on the mind. You know, in classic seven style, you're in the pit of vipers, in the mud, and it's slow and slow. So all this stuff arises. This is the fourth aspect, volitional formations, thoughts about thoughts, emotions. And can you just kind of go and let the story run without feeding a story, without ruminating? Without getting caught up in, oh wow, my heart is heavy. Uh-oh, what does that mean? Oh no, it's depression. I thought I kicked it. I'm now off of antidepressants. Oh no, it's coming back. Or, oh, what will I do about our cat? Oh, I've got a pre-plan every single thing. I'll ward off the heaviness in my heart. Do I really need to do that? So this recognition, this letting be, a roadmap. The Buddha in his roadmap says, you know, everything can be sorted into one of these five in terms of ordinary reality. The fifth aggregate is awareness, consciousness, not in any consciousness at all, and not in any independently arising sense. Awareness arising as a natural process in a body that's alive and has sense organs and various neurological hardware that supports awareness. So amidst all this heaviness, interestingly, is the awareness, the space in which it arises, which it needs to be part of. And I should add as well, with this exploration, this mindfulness, this feeling of being, experiencing the experience. With it is, of course, some experiencing or some seeing of or knowing of the causes of the experience. Without getting caught up in a lot of analysis of those causes, there's a causes. This is, these are some of the potential causes of the body sensations, the feeling tones or hedonic tones, the perceptions, the various thoughts and emotions and desires, the formations, and then awareness. That's it. And a lot. You just kind of hang out with it. You know? I don't know about you, my tendency historically, my personal history in this lifetime, has been to tend to want to suppress or fix unpleasant experiences. Anybody else? Welcome to America, you know, in a lot of ways, right? Sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And don't forget shopping, retail therapy. So, you know, and for me it's been just this beautiful, profound practice that's really 30, 40 years old, but definitely ripening for me in the last 10 or 20. Around, just ride it out, let it be, you know, let the unfolding unfold. Some of these people call it, you know, emptiness rolling on. Then there's the second way to practice. In the transition from the first way to practice to the second and the third, to really observe the movement from being with to working with, movement to wise effort. You probably know in the Noble Eightfold Path, wise effort is essentially summarized as reducing the negative, the harmful, the painful, and increasing the positive, the enjoyable, the beneficial. That's the essence. And in this transition from simply, absolutely, naked, being the first step, moving into what's useful or skillful about wise effort, we've got to be very careful that we're not shifting in our relationship to what we're experiencing in the sense that we start to resist it or go to war with it or overdevelop a sense of I or me in our relationship to it. It's really tricky to do, to engage in wise effort. There's no way to avoid wise effort. You have to make subtle effort to be able to tolerate human beings. To guide yourself to be the most absolutely minimal amount of effort. So as you transition into letting go, you are really careful that you're not repressing the feelings. The mind-brain system is not a flush toilet. It's more like a septic tank. shove that stuff down, it still is with us. So, letting go. I want to call out just a few things around letting go. There's a lot we can say about it. I think arguably half at least of the books, the tools, and so forth, the practices in clinical psychology, broadly defined, are about letting go. So one aspect of letting go is relaxing the body. And that actually supports being with, because as we relax and soften the heart, open to the feelings, we can be with them more fully. So it's okay also that some practices are kind of a two for one. And some of them even are trifecta. And I'll get to that toward the very end. So we relax. We relax. Sometimes also we let go by just taking a break. Again, I don't know which way you tend to tilt. I tend to tilt towards spiritual warrior. I'm going to feel this pain till it either I get rid of it or it kills me, you know? And one of the things that for me was a huge breakthrough on a retreat was when I allowed myself to take a nap and skip a sitting, right? And live with the shame of my well-known empty chair in the back of the room, as if anyone would care, really. So my point is, it's okay sometimes just to take a break. You just can't think about it anymore. Your mother died recently, or you had to put your cat down, or you had a really serious setback, or you got a bad diagnosis. And you know what? I'm gonna watch a comedy. You know what I mean? Or I'm gonna go for it. Or I'm going to reread that novel, which is kind of letting go. Relaxing, taking a break. A really important kind of letting go is letting go of grievance. So often what makes our hearts heavy is the reality and certainly the perception of being wrong. Usually because we really do. We exaggerate the extent of the wrong that was done to us, but in my personal experience, it's actually more common in my experience for people to, minimize or diminish what was actually done to them, or to kind of internalize the repression of themselves, based often on how they were raised, rather than the person who's beating their chest, thumping, you did me dirt. I've been cheated and mistreated, blah, 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 blah. So, okay. Letting be the reality, the form of what was done to us, and we work our way to letting go of that. We don't give up what we saw was actually true, but we go, it's not good for me to keep holding this hot coal. I can let it go, for my own sake, if not for the peace and the harmony between me and this other person. So letting go of grievance, and kind of working our way to okay, that's what it was. And there's a natural rhythm to it. If we push it, it's like trying to massage somebody too fast, too hard, they push you back down. Same way with ourselves. We try to let go of that grievance too quickly. We can kind of feel like we're getting stuck with it. We start ruminating about it. That's a clue. Time to go back to just being for a while. But there is probably there is a natural rhythm in letting go of grievance. And also letting go of self-criticism. That's a huge one, often. Often in a heavy heart is a feeling of, I screwed up, or wow, I feel ashamed of myself, or remorseful, or I hadn't done that, this good thing would have happened, or I wouldn't have missed that opportunity, right? kind of weighs on us often, that's often what really weighs down the heart, is self-criticism. Part of this aspect of practicing the heart, and I'm just calling out things to look at. And it's not an exhaustive list, obviously, but these are big. To let go of self-criticism, to release. I had a guru for a while, teacher, had a profound impact on me. And one of his teachings, or the structure of it, often was around the release-receive cycle. And you can't receive unless you release. So we're talking here about releasing, letting go. It's the second great way to practice. Releasing self-criticism. We are often so hard on ourselves. Don't you feel sometimes like there's some little entity inside with a hammer pounding on your head from the inside? You know, you kind of feel the look in a way, right? Shake it out. Let it go. And then there's the third great way, which is to let in, to receive, to cultivate the wholesome. In a metaphor you may have heard me use, the mind is like a garden. And the first way to practice, we witness the garden. We explore it, we look at it. Maybe the exploration, the being with the mind, including feeling down into softer, more fundamental, more elemental, younger, more wounded, more hurt layers. You just be with it. You let it be. And maybe in the process of that, it might change. Often it actually does. It's kind of like Heisenberg's principle applied at a very macro level, but the observing can actually nudge the experiencing in a different direction. But we don't deliberately, when we are just being there, make any effort to change what's streaming through consciousness. So we just witness the garden. And the second great way to engage the mind, we pull weeds. Right? We release the painful, the difficult, the tension, let go of self-criticism, let's say. And then in the third way, we grow flowers, we cultivate the wholesome garden. So what might we want to cultivate here? I want to call out four in particular. The first is comfort. When your heart is heavy, I don't know about you, when my heart's heavy, I find that what I want to do is kind of curl up in a familiar book. Maybe a new one, but tried and true really works for me. Kind of goes to my childhood. That's a major way I comfort myself. What else comforts you? Maybe it's that cuddly flannel blanket. You know, my bed has looked really good to me the last 36 hours. Maybe it's you know, eating something good. Maybe it's cheating on your diet. You know, sometimes I'm going to swear that I don't want to get down talks. To heck with it, you know, eat that cookie, it's okay, ride out the storm, you know, things will look better in the morning. Maybe it comforts you to make your bed, you know, I would describe my current state as a heavy heart, a kind of a sweet and heavy heart. It's not depressed mood, I know what that feels like, but I would say that for me, if I do get depressed, one of the very first things I do is make my bed, a little comfort. A little corner of orderliness, and I can make something happen, you know. So whatever is comforting for you, right? Comfort. Let in comfort. Turn to others. Others are so comforting. Love your cat. You know, hang out with comfort. Second is perspective. And, you know, it's been foregrounded for me the last several days, kind of in a new way, the emphasis the Buddha put on insight, on clear seeing. That's the meaning of the word vipassana, is insight, recognition, seeing what's true, including impermanence and the emptiness of our experience and the lack of there being an owner of it or an entity inside who's directing the show. when you be with your experience, and especially if you unpack it in the way I described with the Buddha's roadmap of the aggregates, it starts becoming increasingly clear how much like a tapestry experience is. Or in the most recent metaphor that's, you know, landed for me and had a lot of impact, it's like experience is like a movie. So if you think about it, you go to a movie, let's say in the theater or in your home, you see that stuff on the screen, and it looks like all that's all that's there, right? Just same way for us. We have awareness like a screen through which, you know, 22, 24 frames a second are the equivalent these days. You know, imagery is passing. Things are happening on the screen of consciousness. Except we happen to know that to make that movie, you had all these individual actors. And then if you watch the credits roll for 5 or 10 minutes, especially if it's got any kind of special effects, oh my goodness, there are hundreds of people doing things, making things, behind the scenes to manifest that second of imagery on the screen. We had friends who worked for Industrial Light and Magic, and they described to us, you know, a few years ago, it's probably pretty relevant today, that when they were doing some special effects for a whale movie, kind of for Disney, I think, set in the water, to get, you know, like 5 seconds of screen image of the whale underwater, special effects with the light glimmering and the boy and his dog and the whale and whatever. Literally, they'd program it, then they'd go home for the night, and the supercomputers at LucasArts would just grind all night long to create those 5 seconds on the screen. In much the same way, our own experience is just constructed downstream by all these neurons entwining together, weaving into our immune system, our gastrointestinal systems, our hormonal systems, determined and conditioned by, you know, evolution, 3.5 billion years of genetic processes unfolding. You know, literally, it's a cast of billions that's producing this instant of consciousness. Like, wow. And when you kind of relate to the movie that way, you realize there's no director of the movie. There's no screenwriting. There's no Truffaut, no genius auteur who's making this movie happen from soup to nuts, right? It's just this production of thousands of causes and forces and factors producing this instant on the screen of a heavy heart. And when you kind of get that, including through exploring the aggregates and disentangling experience, you acquire perspective. That's the second thing I want to talk about, calling in, letting in, that flower to grow in the garden. We acquire perspective on our own experience. We see it more and more as this kind of impersonal, vast, complex streaming. And in that, what I find so interesting, and I can give you good reasons for a lot of stuff, as you probably know, and they're usually correct, right? Or at least plausible. I don't know why it is. Why is it that when you kind of open out into allness, you open out into the like, whoa, the complexity, the tapestry, the vast net of this moment of experience, why is it that that has some kind of goodness to it, some kind of easing of the pain? Why does the pain ease when you recognize it in a more impersonal way? I have no idea why, but I know it works. So I'm going to try it again the next time my heart is heavy. So we have perspective. So in addition to, of course, our perspective on our particular experience, we have perspective on the situation. Cats die. People die. You know, as a surgeon client of mine once said, Rick, in the OR, we have a saying, all bleeding stops eventually, one way or another, right? You know, things change, things end. You see it in perspective. A woman came to the Buddha, you may know the story, who had just lost her infant child, having had 2 kids myself. I just think that's who are still alive, thank goodness. It's one of the most horrible things that can happen to a person. You know, you lose a child. And she came to the Buddha with her dead baby in her arms and wailing and wailing and said, what can you teach me to make this pain lessen? And he said, all right, I have a little task for you, and then I'll tell you. what the answer is to your question. What I'd like you to do is, I'm probably going to invert this, but I'd like you to go around from house to house to house to house in your village or your area where you live and, you know, collect a mustard seed from every home that has not known death at all. Bring me back some mustard seeds. So she goes to home to home to home to home, and she can't find a home that hasn't known loss. You know, my cousin, my father, my child, my brother-in-law. And she came back to the Buddha and told him her story, and he said, yeah, that's the teaching. And he didn't say it in some dismissive way, but it was to understand this loss in a larger frame. And actually what's interesting, she became a very major dedicated student of his and became enlightened herself. And there's a beautiful passage in the Pali Canon where she's confronted, as the story goes, by some evil figure, like a manifestation of Mara, the metaphoric, if not actual, embodiment of ignorance and delusion and thus evil in the Buddhist frame. And Mara taunts her. He says, you don't have a baby. You don't have a child. You're not really a mother. And he just goes on and on. And she says to him, you know, there's basically no ground over here where your taunts can land. There's no place they can take root in me, you know, because I'm free. So we try to acquire some sense of perspective. Setbacks happen, businesses fade. You know, one of the weirder experiences I had was that I got this really cool history book about the Reformation in the 1300s. I thought I'd be so smart and read the whole darn thing. Will and Ariel Durant, in this major, like, 15-volume history. Anyway, the Reformation, Martin Luther, all that kind of 1300s stuff. And you'd be reading about these amazing people, right, who'd had a major, extraordinary lives, good lives of their time. They had written all these plays. They had run. They were this benevolent governor of this, you know, principality or whatever, province in Germany. You know, wonderful, important lives, scientific discoveries, real contributions. Never heard of them, right? The best they could get was a sentence in this, you know, major textbook about one century in Europe. They got a sentence, or maybe a paragraph if they were lucky. You know, you see things in perspective. Our own personal setbacks get seen in this way. Okay. So perspective, we try to let that in. A third thing, of course, to let in is forgiveness. I think forgiveness is really something to investigate or look for if your heart is heavy. You know? Because often what's weighing us down is some quality of unforgiving, usually of ourselves. So again, it has to be authentic. If we're pushing the river faster than it's flowing, back off. Go back to just being with what's there. But if it feels like wholesome and organic, after exhaling, inhaling, if it feels natural in that way, then forgiveness can arise, including for ourselves. You know, I guess I didn't do that one. Or, okay, I guess I started too late in this life to pull this one off before I kind of get to that point in my lifespan, 70s, 80s at some point, where you kind of say, whoops, you know, time to slow down a little bit. Or maybe you forgive yourself, you know, I lost my temper as a dad, you know. I'm not trying to justify it or excuse it, but yep, in a larger context, that's what happened. I can forgive myself for that without diminishing it at all and without trying to defend against the consequences that may still come my way. So forgiveness, and also forgiveness of other people. And then, of course, last, love. It's so interesting that, you know, we have so many words that describe emotion in an embodied way that involve the heart. A full heart, a happy heart, a loving heart, a heavy heart. That weighed down my heart, you know. I was wounded in the heart. I have heartache, right? And there's something about bringing love opening to the love of others in a very soft and real way, and also giving love to others. That is something to call up, to cultivate, that helps us practice with a heavy heart. It reminds me of this guru I had who said, he described that what we should do is, as he put it, quote, keep the wound of the heart green. Like for him, it was important to keep that wound open, to not let it scab over. You know, the wound of the heart, he called it, that one has for the whole life. He wasn't referring to some specific time when your heart is heavy. He just meant it more generally. And as other people have pointed out, you know, sorrow tenderizes the heart. That the heaviness in the heart can tenderize and open your heart. I notice myself, I just feel definitely softer. And when my own heart is heavy, I can't imagine hurting another person. Isn't that interesting? Just not, or at least volitionally, like, because my heart is heavy right now. So I thought I'd offer myself up for you today, given that I have a heavy heart, kind of give it up for science. But anyway, okay. That's my offering here. How about you? How do you practice with a heavy heart?
Yeah. I was really depressed. And so I drove, I already missed the meditation at Spirit Rock, so I drove out there. And the speaker was talking about difficult emotions. And it was really interesting. Yeah. It was just right where I was at. And for me, just moving really helps. And then also, I talked to him after the talk about two things. One thing was a comment that you made last week about that there are people. You know, there's people in everybody's lives that you can't meet their needs and they can't meet your needs, but you're in a close relationship with them, and that's very difficult and depressing. And then also, as we get older, our parents, sometimes our children, people around us start getting sick at night, and it's just really hard to let go of people that you're very, very close to for many, many, many years.
Yeah.
As they, you know, their bodies fade away and their minds fade away. And that is, you know, very challenging.
Yeah. I thank you for sharing all that, for real. And just to kind of call it out, yes, one of the aspects of letting go is, of course, letting go of conditions. Like, oh, I won't get to marry you. And letting go of that dream. Or, oh, this business, this restaurant is not really going to make it. I need to close it. Or this loved one, this friend, this parent, this cat. I need to let go of that as well. That's definitely true. And to be able to feel the mourning, the grieving, while letting go, and not letting go in order to shove the mourning or grief out the door. When we let go, we try to open the door. It's okay to be a little encouraging, but we don't shove it out the door. We invite it out the door. Okay. How about others? How do you practice with a heavy heart? Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. I feel grief. I just broke my foot, so I'm going through a little bit of grief myself.
Yeah.
I'm used to being really active, and that's a kind of loss to not be able to do all the things I normally do.
Yeah.
But I had a meltdown yesterday, and now I'm back to pretty much normal.
Uh-huh.
So
yeah. Yeah.
I use a lot of what you talked about tonight, actually. Mm-hmm. Thank you for that.
Yeah, for sure. That's great. Thank you. And in the letting go, again, just to call it out, part of it, obviously, is venting. You know, is crying or ranting or, you know, writing those angry letters using your non-dominant hand, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, just whatever it is. You know, you never mail. But anyway, there are various kinds of letting go. Yeah, and venting emotionally. Yeah, other people practicing. Yeah. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. That's great. And if I could, too, I think there's often a kind of rhythm or trajectory in these three ways of letting be, letting go, letting in. And sometimes it's all there, right? You know, like community, that's one of the trifecta. Love is the multivitamin. It's the ultimate universal medicine, you know, and right? Because somehow we can let be and kind of soften and just kind of let down, you know? Let down. That's letting be. Let down in community. And also there's something about community that sort of draws out of us our wounds, you know? And it also lets in all that support. Really beautiful. Please.
Yeah. You know, you're out of your mind, call on faith. But it's basically seeing everything that you see, feel, touch is unreal. All permanence is unreal. So you're kind of there where you could say, okay, this could help me even forgive because everything is kind of like an illusion. But then in a sense, you kind of, you're disengaged with the sympathetic part with, you know, I do truly believe like that where it says the truth, the eighth path fold for, you know, being truth, like, you know, you do have to be your own truth, like, in essence, I would respect that, I want to do my last respects, and when it comes to that time, I will do that, but then there's a part where everything, it's like, don't even try, because other things are happening simultaneously, which I don't even care about, you know, that part I can let go easily, you know, my biggest loss was my mother, but the thing is, on that part, it's like, why even be human then, if you are really, if everything, you know, this book that I read on Buddha by Duke Leach, kind of was real touching. I mean, they were real suffering in their life. I mean, but it's basically seeing everything's illusion. So where's that fine line where, what are we doing on this? They're saying, so from here till the end of a journey, if we reach nirvana, you reach nirvana. But so what is it, all test? Or, you know, that's the kind of place where you get, I get a little bit too dramatizing.
No, just in the interest of time, I mean, I'll be super brief about this very profound question and thing you raise, you know. I'll say it a little bit this way. There is a view in philosophy, it's called idealism, the idea of idea. In certain aspects of Tibetan Buddhism, it comes in, which does regard all appearances as unreal, as non-existent. Which is a very important different thing from saying that we have real constructed perceptions about objectively existing stuff, okay? That's realism, if you will. So we can accept, and the truth is, you can't prove either one. Having tried to, as a sophomore, usually drug-assisted, I could tell you, I don't think you can prove it, because anything you say could be used as evidence you were right. That said, most people, and I think the historical Siddhartha the Buddha, are realists. They presume that there is some complex, objectively existent, material reality about which we have a virtual, constructed reality of perceptions, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So what to do about that? The Buddha himself walked this middle way where he did not buy into hedonism, which says, hey, life's difficult, a lot of times it sucks, party hardy till you die. And the Hell's Angels motto, you know, what's it, you know, live fast, die young, leave a good-looking corpse, you know, right? On the other hand, he rejected nihilism, which is the view not that you personally hold, but that in the back of the room you're representing there, which basically says nothing's real, nothing matters, why not just offer ourselves and, you know, be done with it? He rejected that as well. And you see for yourself how this can show up for you, as I'm going to kind of maybe finish on this point. What you might notice you're having more and more of is this kind of subtle and wholesome unraveling of the mind, a kind of disentangling of mind. It feels less contracted, less congealed, less positional, less stuck, less attached to different views or beliefs or desires. More, and you start feeling more kind of fluid and interdependently arising, more open to life, more affected by life, more kind of like the space through which this momentary wave, this ripple through the vast tapestry of reality is moving in this moment, you know. And then in that, you know, you might have a sense of a kind of wholesome intentionality rippling out from you, expressing itself as petting your cat, you know, who's suffering there, kind of hunkering down by the bathroom, just staring into space. Or you might find yourself naturally moved into creating a stop sign in some busy intersection near your kid's school that's getting too much traffic, you know. Or you might find that in this moment, what works is to shift your posture a little bit. You're getting a little itchy, or your back's getting a little stiff. You know, there's some wholesome intention moving through. And both are there. Both are there, right? We don't need to claim an I inside the mind who's driving that intention, but there is intentionality that seems positive and wholesome that's arising. And I can tell you, this is very much my own personal experience that I just described, and I think it's what people talk about, you know, as they move along in their practice. And I think you're experiencing that as well. So both are true, right? We can recognize that this right here, this moment of heaviness in the heart or effort at work or putting a child to bed or making a cake or driving home or getting a ride, you know, to southern San Rafael, that what's happening right now really is the result of this vast rippling net of causes, you know, the cast of billions, the movie, right? This moment, what's on the screen right now, is the product of the cast of billions. And you can kind of have a sense of that, while at the same time, you know, encouraging wholesome intention and practice that, much as reality ripples into this particular knot, this nexus in the tapestry, also you as this knot ripple outward, out into reality. And both are true, right? There is a rippling into us and through us, and there's a rippling out from us, right? In our contributions to others, our wholesomeness, our loving heart, and our willingness to practice, including practicing with a heavy heart. Both are true. Isn't that beautiful, Wido? Feel it? Both are true. Ripplings into and through, and ripplings out and through. Both. Both true, every moment. How about we sit for a minute and then wrap it up? And after a while, the ripplings into and through and the ripplings out and through just become more and more like one rippling. You know, it gets harder and harder to sort them apart. Thanks for letting me share my heavy heart. It's a lighter heart right now. Thank you. May you too practice with your own heavy heart.